106.6. Listen to Manchester's 106.6, and this is the DVD Fever Show with Dom Robinson. And the DVD Fever Show is a new weekly show where I look through the week's releases in movies and video games, plus the charts, a look at what's new on TV, and news for all three. DVDfever.co.uk is a non-profit website that has recently had a revamp, so please take a look. And if you've got anything to say about anything you hear on the show, please get in touch via the Facebook page. Just go on and search for the DVD Fever Show with Dom Robinson. You'll find it there. And if you want to add me on Facebook, at the moment I've got a picture up with me with a cartoon head mask from Ideal. I may go into it why I did that, why that's there. But if you have a look on the page, you'll see why, because I went through all last week. If you want to have it's better than seeing my own face, basically. Just before that, you heard Blue Sky, Mr. Blue Sky, rather, by ELO, and that was for Lewis Big Lou Jones, who's recently got back into stand-up, and he absolutely stormed it to Beyond a Joke, which is recently hosted by Jamie Kilday, who also does the comedy show, Funny People, on a Saturday afternoon. And then that was a couple of weeks ago, and then he stormed it the following night at the Hope in Stockport. So, anyway, about this show, what we've got coming up in the first hour, we've got a Blu-ray review of the remake of Brighton Rock, the top 10 movie charts, a look at the new cinema releases, including Bridesmaids with Kirsten Wiig, if I might pronounce that wrongly, and Love's Kitchen with Dougray Scott. There's also a look at some new DVD releases, including The Fighter and I Am Number 4, and also some film news. And first of all, we're going to start off with the review of Brighton Rock. Now, this is a remake of the 1947 film directed by John Bolting. The new Brighton Rock changes the setting from the 1930s to 1964 during the Mods and Rockers era, where Kite, the leader of a gang, is murdered by a man called Fred Hale, Sean Harris, on the orders of Mr. Corleone, Andy Serkis. At first, Pinky Brown, Sam Riley, tries to get revenge but is overpowered. However, it's not too long before he finds him and kills him, but there's a catch. The man at the photo booth took an impromptu picture with Hale, where Spicer, Phil Davis, who's on the verge of retirement from the gang, was brought into the photo, as was an innocent girl, Rose, Andrea Riseborough, playing a character who's a world away from her TV drama as Maggie Thatcher. As such, Pinky has to go back and get the slip from Hale's body to get the photo, and thus leave no loose ends. Before long, he charms Rose at a tea room where she works, which is owned by Ida, Helen Mirren, a woman who is shocked by the death of Hale because he was once a gentleman caller of hers. Rose, however, is young and impressionable, while Pinky is, to put it plainly, a wrong'un. Still, that's irrelevant because she's besotted with him and thinks he loves her as much as she loves him. One example of Pinky coming across as a particularly nasty guy was when he was lying on his bed doing the "she loves me, she loves me not," not with a flower or dandelion, whatever they are, but on the legs of a daddy long legs. Nice. Now, I've never seen the original Brighton Rock, and I'll admit I don't know a great deal about it, but that enabled me to come to this with fresh eyes. And in my view, Sam Riley puts on an electric performance as Pinky, and I have Control, where he played Joy Division's Ian Curtis, recorded on from Film Forum and TiVo, and really should get round to watching it at some point. Well, Andrea Riseborough is perfect as a downtrodden Rose. There's also fantastic support from Phil Davis as Long in the Tooth gangster Spicer, and able support from fellow gangsters Craig Parkinson, playing a character called Cubit, and Nonso Anozie, playing a character called Dallow. Mirren and John Hurt are fine in this, although they don't really do much out of the ordinary, with what's more like basically just a cameo from Andy Serkis as mob boss Corleone, with whom Pinky aims to join forces when he realises his own gang is falling apart. Overall, with some neat twists and turns along the way, Brighton Rock 2010 is a film that never outstays its welcome throughout the near two-hour running time, and I thoroughly recommend it. Presented in the original theatrical ratio and in high definition, the movie is nicely filmed and has an engaging visual style that evokes a period of the 60s. Looking sharp and highly detailed throughout. And the sound is perfect as well. In addition to the dialogue, it captures the brooding atmosphere perfectly. There's a few extras on here. If we start off with, there's 82 minutes of interviews. But there's basically a number of interviews in various forms with the director, Rowan Joffe, where he talks about why he remade the original and also the two leads. There's also 10 minutes of deleted and extended scenes, six scenes in total, but while they serve nicely as extras, they don't exactly scream to be put back into the film. One of them features musicians playing, except as this is a deleted scene, there's no music actually to be heard, which is rather amusing. Anatomy of a Scene, The Making of a Record, or The Record, that's a breakdown of the scene where Rosie asks Pinky to record his voice on a piece of vinyl in a recording booth. I mean, that'll make sense when you actually watch the film. Mod or Rocker, which is a brief piece where the cast are asked if they would have been a mod or a rocker. Kenneth Hume's Mods and Rockers, which is a 25-minute modern dance film which utilises the songs of John Lennon, Paul McCartney and George Harrison, as performed by a band called The Shanes, featuring Mick Fleetwood on drums. The short film was later folded into a full-length programme alongside a pair of jukebox shorts, Swinging UK and UK Swings Again, retitled Go Go Big Beat for the US release. There's also an alternative opening sequence storyboard, a stills gallery, a trailer and an audio commentary. Okay, so the film itself, I'd actually give that a good 8 out of 10, because I did really enjoy it. I had made doubts beforehand, because, you know, remakes can't always hit the mark. But, I mean, it probably helped that I'd not seen the original. But, I'd definitely have a look at that. Okay. Now, the next song you're going to hear is Isley Brothers' Summer Breeze, but at the moment the only breeze you're getting is accompanied by Horrible, Horrible Rain. But that's Manchester for you. But anyway, there you go. This is Manchester 106.6, and this is the DVD Fever Show with Dom Robinson. 106.6. That was the Isley Brothers with Summer Breeze, and you're listening to the DVD Fever Show with Dom Robinson on Manchester 106.6. And now we're going to have a look at the film charts. And again, there's no UK charts, once again, as they're usually available from a few places. But and the Internet Movie Database, they said they're trying to get this sorted out, but they're taking their time about it. They've now got some UK charts, which only go up to the end of May. We're now in late June, so that's not very good. Anyway, a number one, unsurprisingly, going straight in, is Green Lantern, which has only taken about $52 million in its first week, and for special effects films, that's not great, really, especially for something that's been heavily promoted. And a few weeks ago, X-Men First Class went straight at number one with only $56 million. Compare that with things like The Hangover 2, which just, like, I think it got about $160 million in its first week, and that's probably not any special effects at all. Anyway, the premise of the Green Lantern is that in a universe as vast as it is mysterious, a small but powerful force has existed for millenniums. Protectors of peace and justice, they are called the Green Lantern Corps, a brotherhood of warriors formed by different races from entire universes, sworn to keep intergalactic order. Each Green Lantern wears a ring that grants him superpowers. But when a new enemy called Parallax threatens to destroy the balance of power in the universe, their fate and the fate of Earth lie in the hands of their newest recruit, the first human ever selected for the Corps, Hal Jordan. Hal is a gifted and cocky test pilot, but the Green Lanterns have little respect for humans, who had never harnessed the infinite powers of the ring before. But Hal is clearly the missing piece to the puzzle, and along with the determination and willpower, he has one thing no member of the Corps has ever had: humanity. With the encouragement of fellow pilots and childhood sweetheart, Carol Ferris, Blake Lively, If Hal can quickly master his new powers and find the courage to overcome his fears, he may prove to be not only the key to defeating Parallax, he will become the greatest Green Lantern of them all. Now you've got Ryan Reynolds taking the lead there, along with Peter Sarsgaard, Mark Strong, and also a cameo from Jeffrey Rush. But from the trailer, it looks like a typical comic book to movie adaptation. Good will triumph over evil, and there's lots of special effects in there and the dash of humour. I wasn't wowed by what I saw on the trailer, but even comic book fans I know who are really looking forward to this have been massively disappointed when they've actually gone to see it. At number two, we've got Super 8, which in the summer of 1979, a group of friends in a small Ohio town witnessed a catastrophic train crash while making a Super 8 movie, and soon suspected it was not an accident. Shortly after, unusual disappearances and inexplicable events begin to take place in town, and the local deputy tries to uncover the truth, something more terrifying than any of them could ever have imagined. Super 8 is written and directed by J.J. Abrams, who's been involved in all the new Star Trek films. There's no one famous in it, really. The trailer shows it's a very expensive special effects movie. It does look like the archetypal summer blockbuster, and one that I'm very much looking forward to. Going straight in at number three, we've got Mr. Popper's Penguins, which I'd never heard of until I looked it up. It's a film that's not actually released in the UK until August the 5th. And it's a live-action family comedy film and starring Jim Carrey, based on the children's book of the same name. Mr. Tom Popper, Jim Carrey, is a divorced realtor whose father travels to many far places around the world during his childhood. When his father dies, a crate containing a penguin shows up at his doorstep. Eventually more penguins arrive, bringing the total to six. Originally intending to donate the penguins to the local zoo, Popper's children fall in love with them, so he decides to keep them. At the same time, Popper is given the task of buying Tavern on the Green, an old restaurant that he used to eat at with his father as a child, with the intent of tearing it down and building a new development in its place. However, its elderly owner, Angela Lansbury, will only sell it to someone who she deems a person of true value. Oh. Do you know what's going to, you can guess what's going to happen before you even go and see it. The rest of the top 10, we've got X-Men First Class at number 4. Number 5 is The Hangover Part 2. Number 6 is Kung Fu Panda 2. And number 7 is Bridesmaids. Number 8, Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides. Number 9, Midnight in Paris. And number 10, Judy Moody and the Not Bummer Summer, which is a kids' film starring Heather Graham. Now, to have a look at the cinema releases, we're going to start off with Bridesmaids, which comes out this Friday. Annie, Kristen Wiig, is a maid of honour whose life unravels as she leaves her best friend, Lillian, and a group of colourful bridesmaids, Rose Byrne, Melissa McCarthy, and a couple of others, on a wild ride down the road to matrimony. Annie's life is a mess, but when she finds out her lifetime best friend is engaged, she simply must serve as Lillian's maid of honour. Though lovelorn and broke, Annie bluffs her way through the expensive and bizarre rituals. With one chance to get it perfect, she'll show Lillian and her bridesmaids just how far you'll go for someone you love. Oh. Well, on last Friday's Film 24 on BBC News, Jason Solomon said that when this comes out, it'll be the funniest movie of the year so far. I can't see that from the trailer. It all looks rather laboured and over the top. He didn't rate Bad Teacher out last week, which looks infinitely preferable to this. Next up, we've got Incendies, which Canadian Nawal Marwan has just passed away. The only people at the reading of her will are her twin adult children, Jean and Simon Marwan, and the executor, Nawal's long-time employer and friend, notary Jean Level. The will contains many unusual requests, the most unusual being two sealed envelopes, one to be delivered by each of the twins to their father and to their brother respectively. The unusual nature of these requests are that the father, as they know, passed away years earlier during the war in the Middle East where Nawal was raised, and they have no knowledge of any other offspring. Simon sees his request as further indication that his mother was crazy, and they will have no part in any of what he sees as her unusual final requests. But Jean wants to respect her mother's final wishes, which means finding out who their real father is and who this unknown brother is. These tasks take Jean on a quest to the Middle East to trace her mother's history, of which she knows little. As Jean goes on a quest, with what little information she has on hand, she finds a history filled with turmoil. Now, the trailer made it look a bit more interesting than the lengthy description, but I'm still not massively sold on it. And over 2 hours in length, it's not one that I'll be exactly rushing to see. By the way, all these films, I've put trailers for them on the Facebook page, so just have a search on Facebook for the DVD Fever Show with Dom Robinson. Next one up, we've got Love's Kitchen. Originally titled No Ordinary Trifle, Rob Haley, Dougray Scott, is an up-and-coming chef and restaurateur in London, and is grief-stricken when he loses his wife. With encouragement from his infamous friend and real-life TV chef Gordon Ramsay, Rob decides to spice up his life by turning a run-down country pub into a gourmet restaurant. His food catches the eye and taste buds of a beautiful American food critic, Kate Templeton, Claire Forlani, And they soon both write a recipe for love that leaves both their hearts and their stomachs full. So just a load of romantic tosh, basically. With their cast that includes Simon Callow, I wasn't wowed by the trailer. Dougray likes Claire and there's a mutual attraction, but she's also got a boyfriend, which complicates matters. Well, don't they all? It just looks like a paint-by-numbers movie. Now, last in the cinema release, we've got a re-release of Akira. When did that come out? I think it was about 1988 originally. Kaneda is a bike gang leader whose close friend Tetsuo gets involved in a government secret project known as Akira. On his way to save Tetsuo, Kaneda runs into a group of anti-government activists, greedy politicians, irresponsible scientists, and a powerful military leader. The confrontation sparks off Tetsuo's supernatural power, leading to a bloody death, a coup attempt, and the final battle in the Tokyo Olympiad, where Akira's secrets were buried 30 years ago. This is a film I've had on video in the past and just never got around to seeing, but this cinema re-release comes just before next week's Blu-ray debut. I watched the trailer and it makes little sense, but it is one of those cult classics, so I really should make time for it. Okay, so that's all the cinema releases that are coming out this Friday. Now, after a song, we're going to be having a look at the new DVD releases out this week. But first of all, the song we've got for you is Living in a Box by Living in a Box. This is Manchester's 106.6.
106.6.
That was Living in a Box with Living in a Box, and you're listening to Manchester's 106.6, and this is the DVD Fever Show with Don Robinson, that's me. And next up, we're having a look at the DVDs out this week, which begin with The Fighter. It would be a mistake to confuse The Fighter with the story of Mark Wahlberg, though the similarities are striking. Completely convincing as a boxer, Wahlberg plays welterweight Mickey Ward, who grew up in working-class Massachusetts. Like the actor-producer, he had 8 siblings, one more famous than the rest. Ward's half-brother, Dickie Eklund, a gaunt, crazy-eyed Christian Bale, turned to boxing first, just as Mark's brother, Donnie, preceded him as a performer, first by singing, then acting. The similarities end there. Dickie, once known as the Pride of Lowell, traded his promising pugilistic career for a crack pipe, and Sugar Ray Leonard cameos as his best-known opponent. As David O. Russell's film begins, the smothering Alice, Frozen River's Melissa Leo, manages Mickey's career, while the unpredictable Dickie attempts to train him. Despite his talent in the ring, though, Mickey can't catch a break until he meets Charlene, Amy Adams, a spitfire of a bartender who encourages him to stand up for himself. When Dickie ends up in a prison and Mickey takes on a more experienced manager, his fortunes start to improve, but it isn't in his nature to abandon the people who raised him. So he attempts to unite the various factions in his life before his shot at the world championship slips away. The Russell paints Mickey's brother, mother, and sisters with a broad brush. Wahlberg anchors the scenario with his patient, level-headed performance. Rescue Me's Jack McGee also serves as his diplomatic dad. Now, based on the trailer, because I've not seen this film in full, it just looks like a tale where Mark Wahlberg loses fights and just can't get the mojo back, but his manager just wants him to do one more. It all just feels like such a tired old storyline that we've seen countless times. Next up, we've got I Am Number 4. There were 9 who escaped. 3 are dead. He is number 4. DJ Caruso, Eagle Eye and Disturbia, helms an action-packed thriller about an extraordinary young man, John Smith, Alex Pettifer, who's a fugitive on the run from ruthless enemies sent to destroy him. Changing his identity, moving from town to town with his guardian honoree, Timothy Oliphant, he is always a new kid with no ties to his past. In the small Ohio town he now calls home, John encounters unexpected life-changing events. His first love, Diana Agron, powerful new abilities, and a connection to the others who share his incredible destiny. Now, science fiction nonsense just seems to be the order of the day with this, and the trailer seems to promise a lot more than it might deliver. Well, a bit more, as this doesn't set the bar particularly high anyway. Also out this week, there's a DVD collection. It's called Doctor Who Earth Story. It's got two, not episodes, but sort of well, it's like several episodes all in one story. Anyway, first one is Awakening with Peter Davison from 1984. The TARDIS has brought the Doctor, Tegan and Turlough to the English country village of Little Hodcombe in 1984, where an alien war machine, the Malus, is affecting its inhabitants. A reenactment of a Civil War battle becomes dangerously real as the Malus gathers sufficient psychic energy to reawake. The other one is called The Gunfighters, starring William Hartnell, from 1966. The TARDIS arrives in the town of Tombstone in the Wild West, and the Doctor, having hurt a tooth on one of Cyril's sweets, decides he must visit a dentist. The local dentist is Doc Holliday, currently engaged in a feud with the Clanton family. Lawman, Wyatt Earp and Bat Masterson, say that one carefully, are meanwhile doing their best to keep the peace. Special features on this one include restored and remastered commentaries with cast and crew documentaries, a photo gallery and a coming soon trailer. Also out this week, got West is West. Now, West is West is a sequel to the internationally acclaimed and successful film East is East. But then you could tell that from the title anyway. It's Manchester 1975. The now much diminished but still claustrophobic and dysfunctional Khan family continues to struggle for survival. Sajid, the youngest Khan, the runt of the litter, is deep in pubescent crisis under heavy assault from his father's tyrannical insistence on the Pakistani tradition and also from the fierce bullies in the schoolyard. So in a last desperate attempt to sort him out, his father decides to pack him off to Mrs. Khan number one and family in the Punjab, the wife and daughters he had abandoned 35 years earlier. It is not long before Ella Khan, Mrs. Khan number two, with a small entourage from Salford, swiftly follows to sort out the mess, past and present. Now, I'll be giving this one a miss. The original I found was just completely overhyped and just seemed to make a joke out of wife beating, which I didn't find anything to laugh at, quite frankly. Other films out this week include How Do You Know?, Howl, The Right, which has got Anthony Hopkins in it, and Rabbit Hole. TV series out this week include Agatha Christie's Marple, Series 5, which is the latest one that's on at the moment. Bored to Death, Season 1. There's three episodes of Midsummer Murders, if you're into that. You've got Death in the Slow Lane, Echoes of the Dead, and Dark Secrets. If you want a bit of classic telly, you've got Sorry, Series 5, Twilight Zone, Series 2, and The Upper Hand, Series 7. And also something that's only just finished recently, which I really enjoyed, Stuart Lee's Comedy Vehicle, Series 2. Okay, so that's all the DVD releases out this week. And we're going to be having a look at some film news in a bit. First of all, we're going to have, very shortly, A Flock of Seagulls, I Ran. 106.6. That was A Flock of Seagulls with I Ran. And you're listening to Manchester 106.6. And this is a DVD Fever show with Don Robinson. And the, that particular song, that's probably the only song that must ever feature the word Aurora Borealis. And it reminds me of playing Grand Theft Auto Vice City, basically, just because it was set in the 80s. But, I'm never tired of playing that. Anyway, in this section, we're going to be having a look at some film news. Starting off with the news that Steven Spielberg and Mark Protasevich are discussing ideas for Jurassic Park 4. Rumours of a fourth Jurassic Park movie have come and gone for years, but with the latest report, it seems like a new film in the series is more likely than ever. A quick recap of the stories about the sequel. Joe Johnston, who directed the third film, as well as this summer's Captain America, was once thought to be the director, but said in 2007 he would not make the film. Prior to that, Steven Spielberg said that if Johnston didn't make the movie, he would. There have been fake scripts, weird rumours, such as dinosaurs with guns, and loads of fan-created images. After Jurassic Park creator Michael Crichton died, producers Frank Marshall and Kathleen Kennedy suggested they might just leave the series at three films. Well, after seeing Jurassic Park 3, they certainly should. But rumours persisted and a new comic book series was put into motion. Now, Steven Spielberg has been meeting with writer Mark Protasevich, who was involved in Thor and also the scrapped Old Boy remake, about ideas for Jurassic Park 4. The report is saying that the two men have met twice to bat around ideas for a fourth film, but stresses that the project is in the very early stages at the best. Mark Prosasevich has not been hired to write, nor has anyone else. I'm not sure I could have a go. No one can make any worse than last time. Universal has not committed to make the movie, although the trade spends a lot of time talking about how the studio likely wants a film that seems like it could be a surefire tentpole hit, and Jurassic Park 4 could conceivably be exactly that. It's been 10 years since the last film in the series, and returns were diminishing. The first one took $915 million, the second $619, and the third only $369 million. But a new sequel, let's hope if this happens it's a sequel rather than a reboot, might do better than the third, at least. With Stan Winston gone, not sure the effects standard of the first will even be equaled, much less topped. Jurassic Park still stands as a remarkably effective effects-based story. And if this did happen, would Spielberg really direct? He's got Lincoln to make, and after that he could be ready for another genre movie. And if it isn't Robo-pocalypse, it could, maybe, be Jurassic Park 4. Also, Hugh Jackman is in talks for Tom Hooper's Les Miserables. This is Tom Hooper's upcoming musical adaptation of Les Miserables. While we don't know which role it's for yet, it's perfect casting either way. For most of us, Jackman is known as a clawed mutant Wolverine, but his true passion lies on the stage, where he's a Tony Award-winning actor who can sing and dance. Now imagine combining the gritty nature of Wolverine with singing and dancing, but not in a campy way. And you'd either have Jean Valjean or Javert, the two male leads of the classic story by Victor Hugo, which was famously turned into a Broadway standard. Variety is on fire, as this was another exclusive of theirs, and they're quick to point out that while Jackman is currently in talks to star in the film, it isn't clear whether it's for the protagonist, Valjean, or antagonist, Javert. Both roles are meaty and equally ambiguous, though as Valjean is an escaped convict who is chased for decades by the lawman Javert during the French Revolution, I wager it's Valjean. Universal is putting together the project, and once they've got Hooper, who won the most recent Best Director Oscar for The King's Speech, they've been pushing it hard. Jackman had a significant gap in his schedule open up once The Wolverine, which is supposed to be shooting by now, fell apart, though he's been attached to several different projects and turned down others. This one comes with a high pedigree and a finished script by Bill Nicholson. Now, tomorrow we're going to have some more film news. You'll be finding out what Russell Crowe is going to be up to in Superman. There'll be some Transformers news and what happened to Kate from Lost. But in the meantime, you're going to listen to Biffy Clyro with Many of Horror. This is Manchester's 106.6.
106.6.
Well, that was actually Biffy Clyro's When We Collide. Unless it's been retitled Many of Horror, but that's what I've got here. But anyway, you're listening to Manchester's 106.6, and this is the DVD Fever Show with Don Robinson, and we're still having a look at some of this week's film news. Now, I mentioned we're going to have a look at what Russell Crowe's going to be up to in the new Superman film. He's in talks to play Jor-El in Man of Steel. Now, if there's anyone out there badass enough to be father of the Man of Steel and to follow in the footsteps of Marlon Brando, Russell Crowe might be it. According to Variety, he's currently in talks to play Jor-El in Zack Snyder's Superman film Man of Steel, plus his wife might be played by Connie Nielsen. Variety exclusively broke the news of Crowe's probable casting, saying that the producer, Christopher Nolan, had long wanted a huge name to play Superman's biological father. According to the piece, Sean Penn and Clive Owen were both considered, but Crowe was the first choice to portray Jor-El. He'll join a cast that includes Henry Cavill as Superman, Amy Adams as Lois Lane, Michael Shannon as General Zod, and Kevin Costner and Diane Lane as Ma and Pa Kent, Superman's Earth parents. They're apparently also looking for a big-name actress to play Jor-El's wife as Superman's biological mother, Lara. And according to Latino Review, that actress might be Connie Nielsen, Crowe's Gladiator co-star. An offer is reportedly out to her, as well as to Harry Lennox, Crowe's State of Play co-star, to appear in the film. With the larger-than-life Oscar winner playing Jor-El, it's hard not to think of Marlon Brando in Richard Donner's original. Everyone has said that David Goyer's script for Man of Steel isn't a straight origin. He said it's a new modern take on the character, but casting seems to mirror the 1978 film, complete with Zod and both as Superman's Kryptonian parents. Brando got top billing in both the original and second films, even though he relatively played a minor role. A bit like Apocalypse Now, then. Production on Man of Steel is set to start shooting next month in Illinois, evidenced by a recent open casting call for extras they can read, well, they'll be reading about soon. But what do you think about Russell Crowe and possibly Connie Nielsen playing Superman's parents? Also happening is that Shia LaBeouf and Michael Bay are quitting Transformers. This bit of news can be taken either as sad news or the best news since the announcement of the reboot of the Batman series. Director Michael Bay and star Shia LaBeouf are announcing that Transformers Dark of the Moon is to be the last of the Transformers films. Shia LaBeouf says point blank, "I'm not coming back to do another one." He goes on to say, "I don't think Mike will either. Transformers is still a hot property, especially coming out of the third one, so imagine they'll reboot it with somebody else." If Paramount does decide to make a rebooted franchise, LaBeouf said he'd be happy to go and see it, and also called Dark of the Moon their best movie out of the three. Now, do you ever want to know what happened to Kate from Lost? Well, Evangeline Lilly, and would you believe it, Dame Edna, are going to join the cast of The Hobbit. So it looks like what Kate did is head to Middle-earth. Peter Jackson announced via Facebook on Sunday that former Lost star Evangeline Lilly has been added to the cast of The Hobbit. She'll play a new character, the woodland elf, Toriel. And while Jackson refused to elaborate further, he did write that Toriel would not be a love interest for Legolas, Orlando Bloom. Barry Humphries, a.k.a. Dame Edna, was also added to the cast as the Goblin King. Okay, that's the end of the first hour. Coming up in the second hour, we've got a mixture of video games and TV, starting with a review of Crysis 2 on the Xbox 360. You're listening to Manchester 106.6, so this is the DVD Fever show with Dom Robinson. And as we're close to the top of the hour, we're going to get there with Art of Noise and Close to the Edit. 106.6. You're listening to Manchester 106.6, so this is the DVD Fever show with Dom Robinson. And in the second hour, we're going to be having a look at some video game stuff and also TV, starting with a review of Crysis 2 on the Xbox 360, the top 10 games charts, some new video games releases, including Super Street Fighter 4, plus some video games news. The TV, there's also a look back at Luther on BBC One. Let's look ahead to some more programmes coming up, and also some TV news. So I'm going to start off with a review of Crysis 2, which came out a little while ago, but it's one of the best games of the year so far, so it's worth a mention. Now, Crysis 2 is like what would happen if you were in New York and the full effects threatened by the 2012 movie were felt, and then the aliens came to blast seven shades of stuff out of what was left. Now, normally a game that's full of aliens, particularly a first-person shooter, gets on my nerves because it takes me too far out of reality. And you could also murder me for saying that this happens, that very little happens a lot in video games. It's going to be much based in reality, although titles like the Call of Duty series have addressed that. But here, as the baddies dump about, they're basically like humans in suits, albeit with their faces completely covered. Spread over 18 levels and taking place in 2023, 3 years after the original game, which I confess I never played, the basic plot is that you're one of the US Marine Corps who dropped in with a view to rescuing former Crynet employee Dr. Nathan Gould, who it transpires may know now how to defeat the pesky aliens. However, like all good plans, things go wrong. Almost every other Marine is killed as they blow up your submarine, and it's just you, Alcatraz, and Delta Force Major Lawrence Prophet Barnes, who's wearing the nanosuit 2.0. Since he's been infected with the Manhattan virus, he gives you the suit and tops himself, so the suit disassociates itself with him, and you'll find that when Gould comes across the intercom, he still refers to you as Prophet because he has no idea about the Major's fate. So what does a nanosuit do? Well, it comes with a futuristic HUD or head-up display that enables you to perform power jumps. It's also an icon measuring enemies' awareness of you, and it comes complete with a temporary cloak device. Also, you can follow the markers with a distance meter to tell you how far in and in which direction you should be going. Prior to starting Crysis 2, I was playing another of this year's big hits, Homefront. And it's difficult not to make comparisons because both are portraying a dystopian future following the collapse of society at the hands of enemies with guns, but it's clear that this game contains much nicer and more fluid graphics, especially when it comes to explosions. They're lush. You can also play it in 3D if you have an HD TV, which is fully 1080p compatible, but I don't. The sound is also similarly kick-ass. It's Dolby Digital 5.1, as you'd expect, and once you get hold of it, HMG, as Ash says in Army of Darkness, this is my boomstick. It's one for when you need to just blow everyone, not just out of the water, but out of existence. When playing through one particular level, I can only sum this up as being completely awesome. I did have another word in there, but I can't say that at this time of day. Baddies shoot, I duck, take shots when I can, and at times when their numbers are getting blown away and the odds are building in my favour, I charge at them and they run. Ha ha ha. At times the AI is absolutely phenomenal. It feels like it sets a new benchmark in first-person shooters, although there are others when a baddie hides and you can easily walk up to him and riddle his head with bullets. At one point, it was quite amusing to see that a baddie can indeed be killed by one of his mate's grenades. As I ducked out of the way, the explosion came, and I heard, "Man down!" Wah! In this game, you can be stealthy or fire aplenty. There are times when you need to adopt one approach before heading to the other, so both have their plus points, and the atmosphere draws you into the point where you're not going to do anything stupid, unless you want to see what just lies ahead before you then go back and have a sensible crack at things. Now, I know you have a nano suit and can engage cloak and heavy armour and all that, but this game features stuff about taking tissue samples from aliens and integrating this with your nano suit, and it can indeed be done, but quite frankly, I didn't really get this side of it. And sometimes you just want to take your fantastic weaponry and kick ass big style. The cloak can lead you into a full sense of security too. After switching it on, you'll head out thinking you're invincible, then you'll use all your suit's energy on the thing. Not only will you have enough left to kick cars and other items, or will you not have enough energy left to kick cars and other heavy items about so they land on the enemy, you'll also show up right in front of them at the most inopportune moment. One niggle in this game is that you can pick up things in any room and throw it about, but it doesn't make any noise. Whoever thought that big heavy objects being as silent as a pillow? Okay, you can turn up the amp, you might hear a bit of a clank, but it's a million miles from what this title can deliver, as you'll find when you practically shoot everything up. The limited edition of this game includes bonus content which can be downloaded online with the code supplied in the box, and includes a SCAR Assault Rifle Digital Camouflage, which is a medium assault rifle with high accuracy and fire rate. A SCAR Hologram Decoy, which is a weapon attachment that can project a moving holographic mirror of the player, allowing him to deceive and confuse enemies. A unique platinum dog tag. These display the player's multiplayer rank and stats against a customizable frame and background image, and these can be viewed by other players and are used to help identify players more easily in the game. And also bonus XP, which this awards additional experience points that immediately boost the player up to rank 5, giving access to present class loadouts in multiplayer. A Crisis 2 is everything that Homefront isn't. And for those looking for a superb single-player campaign that's as much fun as Call of Duty Black Ops, then get this now. And once you combine this with the amazing visuals, letting rip with your entire arsenal, it felt like World War III had come to my street. At the time of publishing this review, I've uploaded 3 pieces of gaming footage. If you have a search on YouTube for DVD Fever games, you'll find them. None of them are full levels, as I spent my time just simply getting into it all. And I'm not very good at it. I die an awful lot. That doesn't stop it from being bloody good fun, though, despite some very bizarre glitches, some of which are displayed in the footage. I couldn't help but give, well, pretty much everything 10 out of 10, graphics, sound and playability and the enjoyment of the game, which obviously makes it an overall 10 out of 10. Okay, so that's your review of Crysis 2 on the Xbox 360. In a moment, we'll be having a look at the games charts. And very soon we'll be hearing Dead or Alive, You Spin Me Round Like a Record. So it's Manchester's 106.6.
106.6.
Yeah, that was Dead or Alive with You Spin Me Round. And you're back on the DVD Fever Show with Don Robinson on Manchester's 106.6. First of all, we'll have a quick look at the top 10 games charts this week. Going straight in at number 1, we've got Duke Nukem Forever. Number 2, it's down to number 2 for L.A. Noire. Number 3, it's up for Zumba Fitness. Number 4, it's straight in for Infamous 2. Number 5, it's down for Lego Pirates of the Caribbean. Number 6, it's Dirt 3. Number 7, Brink. Number 8, it's a new entry for Red Faction Armageddon. And down to number 9, it's Call of Duty Black Ops. And down to number 10, it's Portal 2. There's also some re-entries this week, which include number 21, EA Sports, Mixed Martial Arts. Number 30, Shift 2 Unleashed. And EA Sports Active 2 at number 35. That's also some of the video games that are out this Friday, starting with Fear 3. Now, Fear 3 is the first-person shooter that blends classic single and multiplayer combat with the unforgettable horror survival gameplay that the Fear franchise is known for. The third game in the Fear series, Fear 3 continues the intricate storyline, tying together the psychically dangerous mother, Alma Wade, with her two sons, Point Man and Paxton. Paxton Fettel, as well as the Fear Operations team. Players take control of both Point Man and Paxton Fettel at different times in the game, utilising each's unique abilities and powers in a dark adventure that will test the player's loyalties, combat skills and sense of duty. Additional features include a co-op and multiplayer modes, cinematics and story input by John Carpenter and Steve Niles, and additional downloaded content available online. The story is that 9 months ago, Point Man and his Fear Squad were trapped to stop a telepathically gifted cannibal who had begun a murderous rampage. Point Man learned that the target was his brother, Paxton Fettel, working along the tortured and psychically powerful mother, Alma Wade. Despite this revelation, Point Man followed orders to destroy them and subsequently ravaged the surrounding city and most of his Fear team. Now it is clear that Alma's psychic influence survived, and worse, she is about to birth something that could destroy the world. Fettel has returned from death, as you do, with an unclear agenda, refusing to leave Point Man's side and asking for help to reach Alma. The remaining Fear Squad is still trying to complete their mission. With the chain of command broken and Point Man calling his own shots, where will his allegiance lie? Now, this is the film I really want to get, because I love the first one, and played some of the original. Everything to do with Alma was just spooky as hell, and the gameplay trailer for this, which is on the Facebook page, is just amazing. Also out is Shadows of the Damned, which is an all-new psychological action thriller from the iconic Japanese developers, including executive director Suda51, director of No More Heroes, and music composer Akira Yamaoka, who did the sound on Silent Hill. Heavily influenced by the grindhouse style, including projects from Quentin Tarantino and Robert Rodriguez, Shadows of the Damned presents a unique vision of hell, taking gamers on a twisted journey through a demented underworld where death and destruction are around every corner. Shadows of the Damned follows a demon hunter named Garcia Hotspur deep into a hyper-demented reimagining of hell, where he must rescue the love of his life by defeating the armies of darkness with the power of the light. Shadows of the Damned delivers shocking and unique gameplay experiences that include over-the-top action, grandiose boss battles, demented puzzles, grotesque enemies, heart-pounding moments, and psychotic imagery. Brace yourself for one hell of a trip to the City of the Damned. Well, that's what it says there. I mean, I looked at the gameplay. It didn't grab me. You shoot one zombie, then another, and so on. The end. Pass. Also this week is Super Street Fighter 4 Arcade Edition, which features a roster of 39 playable characters, all unlocked out of the box, with four new characters, including classic combatants from previous Street Fighter games. Beyond characters, Super Street Fighter 4 Arcade Edition adds all new balancing, as well as an enhanced replay channel. But do we need another Street Fighter game? I don't think so, because it's just a typical 2D fighting action game. Other games out this week include, there's one for Transformers Dark of the Moon. It has been 3 years since Megatron and the Decepticons last threatened the world. Earth's leaders believe that Megatron has fled the planet, in defeat, but Optimus Prime knows better. An alien transmission is intercepted, exposing Megatron's plan to spread chaos and fear amongst the humans and unleash the ultimate Decepticon assassin Shockwave. The Autobots must hunt Megatron, neutralise the Shockwave, and save their home from destruction at the hands of the Decepticons. That's out on most formats. You've got the Xbox 360, PS3, Wii, the DS, and the 3DS. And other games out this week include Arcana Heart 3 on the Xbox 360 and PS3, Murder in Venice on the Nintendo DS and Cubic Ninja on the 3DS. Okay, that's all your new, well, your charts and also your new releases for this week. In a moment, we'll be having a look at some video games news. And but first of all, we're going to be having Go West, We Close Our Eyes. This is Manchester's 106.6.
106.6.
That was Go West with We Close Our Eyes. And you're listening to the DVD Fever Show with Don Robinson. And you're on Manchester's 106.6. Now, we're on the bit of video games news, but I'm just going to start with a little bit of gadget news first. Because some things that have close to my heart in a way. HTC are saying, actually, we will bring Android 2.3 to the Desire. HTC has changed its mind again and confirmed that it will be bringing the Android 2.3 update to the HTC Desire. Just 24 hours after delivering the grim news that it wouldn't be able to upgrade the popular Desire to Gingerbread, which is 2.3, the Taiwanese manufacturers just basically turned around and said that they will be doing it. This has obviously brought relief to the many, many users of the top-selling HTC phone who thought the promise of 18-month support for Android upgrades wasn't going to be upheld, but has understandably caused confusion for customers. TechRadar has contacted HTC for further information on how the phone, which was deemed to have too little memory for the Android 2.3, has suddenly got the necessary specs to run the operating system version. There's still no word on when the update will be coming, but we can imagine if there's this much to-ing and fro-ing from within the organisation, it can't be too long now. I mean, when it does come, it'll certainly bring relief to me, because I have an HTC Desire head, and while it doesn't say if it was due to affect anyone other than regular Desire owners, I wouldn't put it past HTC to take forever to do anything. After all, I've been having the problem of self-deleting texts for months now, and despite trying to contact them on the matter, they have done absolutely nothing about it. Now, there's also some video games news that the registration for the closed beta of Family Guy Online opened last week. Do you not know there was a Family Guy Online? Well, neither did I. Some basic snooping reveals, however, that the game will run in a web browser and will feature two currencies, cash and clams. The description for clams leads me to believe that it will be the primary currency of the game and is earned by doing things and accomplishing tasks that you might be challenged to complete. Therefore, cash is likely to be obtained with real money. We also know it's allegedly launching this autumn. An animation loop on the website of Mayor Adam West shows a smooth-looking cel-shaded model. If the game itself looks as good, there could be potential here. It could also be a total no-effort cash cow. Also, the Wii U, so that's a follow-up to the Wii, is going to be releasing in April 2012. So that means it's going to miss the first quarter altogether. Nintendo of America President Reggie Phil Aim narrowed down the Wii U's launch window on Late Night with Jimmy Fallon, stating that the system will not release until after April 2012. Nintendo systems have historically been released during the first or fourth quarter of the year, between the months of November and March. A few exceptions would be the June release of the Nintendo DS Lite and the late May arrival of the GameCube in Europe. Such a precedent and the opportunity for Nintendo to demonstrate a tangible launch lineup at E3 2012 makes a holiday season 2012 release date likely for the Wii U. The Wii U controller features a 6-inch touchscreen, traditional buttons, a camera, microphone, stereo speakers, gyroscope and an accelerometer. Up to 4 Wii remotes can also be used with each Wii U system. And the system is also rumoured to be 50% more powerful than the current generation systems such as the PS3 and the Xbox 360. Okay, so that's your video games news, and that's it for the video games section. We're going to have a look at some TV stuff coming up, including a look back at Luther, which started up again last Tuesday. This is Manchester's 106.6, and time for a little bit of things that make you go,
106.6.
You're listening to Manchester's 106.6. This is the DVD Fever Show with Don Robinson. And that was CNC Music Factory with Things That Make You Go, What made me go, last week was the return of Luther on BBC One. I thought this Luther's a wonderful cop show with Idris Elba from The Wire and Thor as Maverick cop John Luther. This is a show I've been looking forward to more than the return of most. Still plagued by the death of his ex-wife, Luther returns to work to face a surreal and nightmarish case of the masked murderer determined to enter into folklore. As the body count rises, Luther must use all his skills to stop the killer, at the same time trying to rescue an old acquaintance's daughter from a dangerous world of prostitution. As it began, we saw Alice being interrogated by psychologist Martin Schenck, while Luther was sat playing Russian roulette in his squalid flat. There was a murderer going round with a sort of weird punch mask on, as if like Punch and Judy. He would kill the women, then phone the contacts on their phone and spout a weird, seemingly religious chant. Justin had been busted down to a regular policeman, although 2 years seemed to have passed, as that's how long he was meant to be in uniform for, but he was quickly brought back to the rank of detective early on in the first episode. A woman called Caroline Jones comes into Luther's life and says her daughter is being paid by men to participate in some sexually degrading videos. Luther then goes to visit Alice in a psychiatric ward, but it wasn't exactly Silence of the Lambs nor Manhunter. By the end of the episode, it hadn't resolved anything, or everything, making me realise there'll be a story arc that runs throughout the series. And there's only 4 episodes this time round, but at least it's better than there just being 2 planned originally. I thought the cliffhanger resolution was very dissatisfying, but it's still good to have Luther back, and the alternative could have been a whole series of him being on the run, which really wouldn't have worked. I've got a bit of a look ahead to some of those things coming up. First up, we've got Fool Us with Penn and Teller. Now, Jonathan Ross hosts a new series in which world-famous magical double act Penn and Teller challenge aspiring illusionists to perform their most baffling trick in front of a studio audience. If the hopefuls manage to fool the Grand Masters of Magic, they win the right to perform with the duo in Las Vegas. In the first show, comedy magician Mark Shortland gives Jonathan the fright of his life. French genius Matthew Biche is stupendously mysterious. Double act Young and Strange give stage illusions their own special twist. And card shark Daniel Madison shows why casinos are scared of him. After facing the challenges, Penn and Teller will close the show with a fantastic new trick of their own. Now, I saw the one-off at New Year, and it was okay, but I don't think it's something I'd care to watch on a regular basis. So I'll give, you know, I've made a series out of it. I'll give this one a try. I'll see, you know, see what it's like, see whether they've upped the game or anything on it. The other thing that's out this week, well, it's actually on Monday at 10 o'clock next week, so a little bit to go, but it's still before next week's show. The first episode of a new comedy series called Sirens. The British Comedy Award winner, Kayvan Novak, Rhys Thomas and Richard Madden, saw in a 6-part comedy series from Brian Phillips, inspired by Tom Reynolds' book Blood, Sweat and Tea. To the outside world, Stuart, Ashley and Rashid look like angels of mercy. To their colleagues, they're a trio of pedantic know-alls. And to the career alcoholics and late-night revelers on the swarming streets of Leeds, they're nothing more than glorified taxi drivers with one drop-off point, accident and emergency. In the opening episode, the team attend a major road traffic collision where Stuart takes a radical decision to give an open-heart massage to jumpstart a woman's heart. Back at A&E, the lads feel the effects of the shock and adrenaline, and are forced to see the hospital counsellor. Now, I've said there've been a few sort of weird trailers, and they just don't really seem to work. It's obviously one of these comedies where, thankfully, there's no laugh track in the background, but it just makes me wonder whether is there an audience and they're just not laughing, because it's just not. I don't know, maybe the trailers are not painting it the best light they could, so I'll give it a go, and I'll see what I make of it. Also, I mean, the whole thing, the show lasts 1 hour, and normally it's the kind of thing you'd expect to last half an hour, so why it's lasting an hour, God alone knows, but, well, find out by watching it. So that's on at, so we've got Penn and Teller, which I don't think I mentioned when that was on. That's on ITV at Saturday at 8 o'clock, that's Fool Us. And Sirens is on next Monday at 10 o'clock on Channel 4. Now, in a bit, we'll be having a look at some TV news. But first, we're going to have a song. And we're going to have, the song about me, a night owl. It's Jerry Rafferty. This is Manchester 106.6.
106.6.
That was Jerry Rafferty with Night Owl. And you're back with the DVD Fever Show, Don Robinson, on Manchester's 106.6. And we're into the last bit of the show now with some TV news. There's a fair bit to get through, starting with a look at some new BBC Three shows which are coming up. And that's because they've got a new controller, Zai Bennett, who's come from ITV2. Zai says that making our audience laugh is one of our key aims at BBC Three. We have been the home of some of the most brilliant and innovative new comedy in recent times, and we hope Life Stories with Sharon Horgan will add to that, and also that Will Meller in White Van Man will go from strength to strength. Now, Life Stories, which is a working title, is a brand new comedy series written and starring Sharon Horgan from Pulling, the increasingly poor decisions of Todd Margaret, and comedian Holly Walsh, the co-star of the TNT show and all over the place. Helen Stevens, Sharon Horgan, has never done anything wrong in her life, apart from the time she was stopped for drink driving. So when she's falsely imprisoned for the murder of her boss, she knows it's only a matter of time before this horrible mistake is sorted and she's back to her old life. The only problem is her fiancé and alibi, Justin, prefers her being in prison because he just can't face dumping her. Plus her younger sister, Laura, is quite happy she's inside as she's moved into her flat and has taken her place in the pub quiz team. And Henry, the weirdo from work, is beginning to realise his weekly prison visits are the only guaranteed way to spend time with her. If that's not enough, a lawyer, Tony, is a specialist in an injury at work claims and thinks that shouting, "You can't handle the truth," amounts to a convincing defence. Despite all this, Helen is determined to stay optimistic and to get out with her dignity intact. All she has to cope with now is a prison governor who believes her appeals are bad for morale and an arsonist cellmate who just wants a hug. Against the backdrop of life in Broadmarsh Prison, Life Story is a sitcom with a little murder mystery thrown in, as Helen fights to prove her innocence by finding her boss's real killer. Whoever it is, he or she is still on the loose and could kill again. Now, BBC Three cancelled Pulling after two series and a special, so why can't they just bring that back? They have a new controller now, after the previous guy, Danny Cohen, went off to ruin BBC One, so why not just correct previous mistakes? Anyway, another show that's coming up is one called Wilfred, which is a half-hour live-action comedy about Ryan, a young man struggling unsuccessfully to make his way in the world until he forms a unique friendship with Wilfred, his neighbour's dog. Elijah Wood, from the Lord of the Rings trilogy and Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, stars as Ryan, and Jason Gann plays the title character Wilfred. Everyone else sees Wilfred as just a dog, but Ryan sees a rude, somewhat surly, yet irrepressibly brave and honest Australian bloke in a cheap dog suit. While leading him through a series of comedic and existential adventures, Wilfred the dog shows Ryan the man how to overcome his fears and embrace the world around him. Wilfred is based on the critically acclaimed Australian series of the same title and was adapted by David Zuckerman, who's in charge of, who worked on Family Guy, American Dad and King of the Hill. Also, hit comedy series White Van Man returns for another six-episode series. Back in Maplebury, Ollie, Will Meller, the proverbial man with a van, is struggling to do the right thing when all around him Darren, Joel Fry, is doing wrong. The series will once again be written by acclaimed comedian Adrian Poynton and see the return of the original ensemble cast. Now, I watched one episode of this. I didn't think it was great, but it did get an audience of over 2 million viewers, which is pretty good for BBC Three. So, that's why I'll be coming back. There's also a couple of new comedy pilots coming up on BBC Three. Eggbox, which is a half-hour comedy drama about life on a teenage cancer ward, written by Tom Bidwell and Mark Catley. Tom wrote the Oscar-nominated short film Wish 143 about a teenager with cancer who has to lose his virginity before he dies. And Tom himself survived cancer when he was 15. Mark Catley is a consultant producer on Casualty and has written for Holby City, Casualty and EastEnders. Also another pilot, IED, is a single-camera comedy about British bomb disposal detachment. It's a show about something the public easily forget. Soldiers really enjoy being soldiers. This sitcom shows us why, as it takes the audience from the moments of intense action to the fractious camaraderie as the unit waits around for their next tasking. IED is written by James Carey and Richard Hurst, who, between them, have co-written 12 episodes of the award-winning BBC Two hit Miranda. It's produced by Stephen McCrum, who also produced the BAFTA-nominated BBC One smash Mrs. Brown's Boys, and BBC Three's multi-award-winning adult puppet comedy, Mongrels. Also in film news this week, Nicholas Stapleton returns to EastEnders as Mandy Salter. They told him the residents of Albert Square are in shock when Tearaway Mandy Salter, played by Nicholas Stapleton, returns to EastEnders. Last time viewers saw Mandy, she was a troublesome teen who fled Wolford not long after a boyfriend, Aidan, Sean Maguire, returned to Ireland. Manny has grown up a bit since then, but she's still fun, chaotic and wild, with a spiteful streak. Manny is a manipulative force of nature, so it's more likely she'd be causing trouble for at least one of Wolford's well-known residents. Nicola Stapleton says, I'm looking forward to playing Manny again. It'd be interesting to see what she's been up to all this time. I'm excited to coming back and working with some old friends. Also in TV news this week, Douglas Hodge and Jessica Hines star in One Night for BBC One. Jessica Hines from Doctor Who in 2012 and Douglas Hodge, Robin Hood, Mansfield Park and Unforgiven star in an intense and compelling new four-part drama by Paul Smith for BBC One made by BBC Drama Production. Set over one blisteringly hot summer's night, when nerves are frayed and tensions ride high, One Night is a story of four ordinary people whose fates are linked by a seemingly inconsequential event. In each episode, the events of the night are retold from a different character's point of view, asking the question, how well do we really know each other? Hilary Salmon, executive producer on BBC, says, Paul Smith's raw and funny scripts look in intricate detail at four real lives, within an ambitious and original framework. We watch with growing empathy and alarm as each of the four characters tries to do the right thing for themselves and their families, but is scuppered by misunderstanding and misperception. Episode 1 opens with Ted's, Douglas Hodge's, story. After years of hard work, Ted's future looks uncertain. It is crucial the barbecue he is throwing for his boss, Kenny, is a big success. When an abusive teenager from the nearby estate refuses to pick up the litter dropped outside Ted's house, he decides to take action. Little does he know the ripples of his decision will change his life, and those of the other characters forever. In episode two, the story centres on Rochelle, Georgina Campbell, the seemingly rebellious teenager from Ted's story. But will Rochelle's bright academic future be in jeopardy because of Ted's actions? Episode 3 focuses on Carol, Jessica Hines, Rochelle's mum. Carol has to contend with three kids and a job she dislikes. She also harbours an ambition to have her own on-stage career. But when eldest son Jake tells her the police are looking for him, will she defend him or hand him over? And finally, Billy Matthews plays 12-year-old Alfie in the final episode, a few hours short of his 13th birthday, after an evening out with his mates. A rite of passage event forces him to make up the most grown-up decision of his life. The cast also includes Saskia Reeves from Luther and Canoe Man as Sally, Ted's long-suffering life. And one last little bit of TV news for you. For those who are a fan of this, a new professional dancer will join Strictly Come Dancing 2011. Strictly Come Dancing has announced a lineup of professional dancers for the next series, including a new male dancer. Pashla Kovalev, who hails from Siberia and specialises in Latin, will take his place on the dance floor alongside a host of familiar faces. The other male dancers are reigning champion Artem Chigvintsev, Brendan Cole, Anton De Beck, James Jordan, Vincent Simone and Robin Windsor. The female dancers waltzing back onto the show this year will once again be Erin Bogue, Flavia Kakachi, Ola Jordan, Natalie Lowe, Christina Rianoff, Aliona Villani and Katja Vershilas. The show's executive producer, Moira Ross, says, I'm delighted to welcome back our Strictly Professionals and really excited about introducing our new dancer, Pasha, to our audiences, with some exciting treats in store for Series 9. The last series, Dance Troupe, will not be back when the show returns on BBC One this autumn, which the new autumn schedules tends to be the first Saturday in September. Anyway, that's all your TV news for this week and everything for the show, for all your stuff on movies, video games and TV. That's been the DVD Fever show with Don Robinson. That's me. Thank you very much for listening. This is Manchester's 106.6 and I'm going to be playing out with a song which, you could say it's to do with the movies in a way. There was a few times a guest on Jamie Kilday's film show. He's now doing the comedy show on Saturday afternoons. And this is it's been a long time since I heard this song, but I was reminded of it when they played it during his particular show. It's Baz Luhrmann Everybody's free to wear sunscreen. This is Manchester's 106.6.